You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, with guest host Julia Paris, Go to Work with David Cameron, Obamacare, The Daily Mail, Radio 1, TV Review, and the Pretend iPod.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the Parish Council, the podcast from the Rocking Vicar. My name is Terence Dackham, and she is writer, stand-up comedian, singer and broadcaster. She's Juliet Harris.
Hello. That's a very grand introduction. I feel I'm doing all of those things on an amateur basis, can I just point out? I'm an enthusiastic amateur rather than having any level of sort of big I am about me.
I like that introduction. I worked on it quite a lot.
I think you should have been sort of wearing a glitzy jacket when saying that, really.
Yeah, well, that's how I'm picturing you, but, you know, don't dispel the illusion completely. We're recording this, Julia, as you and I know, on Wednesday, the 2nd of October, and it's the day that David Cameron gave his keynote speech to the Conservative Conference in Manchester.
This is true.
And one of the most reported aspects of the Conservative Conference has been moves to bring our benefit system even closer to the work for welfare model. And this is what Mr. Cameron said earlier. This is a quote. He said, "Today it is still possible to leave school, sign on, find a flat, start claiming housing benefit and opt for a life on benefits. And we've got to offer them something better than that." So, Juliet, my opening question for you is, if someone has been out of work long term, really, what's wrong with asking claimants to get into the habit of routine, getting up in the morning, gaining some work experience, attending a job centre to receive support for finding work? It's a good thing, surely?
Well, yes. I mean, I suppose I've actually signed on before. I suppose I can start with my personal experience. When I left, I went off to university. I went to school. I went straight on sixth form college. I went off to university to study law. I then left university straight away and went on to law college for a year. Made all best attempts to try and secure a job for after I finished and couldn't, because as anybody that's had anything remotely to do with trying to get a job in the legal industry will know, it is insanely competitive. And this was 7 years ago, so this was before legal aid cuts and quite a lot of the parts of the law profession were sort of closed down, if you see what I mean. But that's another conversation we could have. But I didn't have a job when I left law college, and I went back to my parents, my room in my parents' spare room, which now had my mum's sewing machine in it, and and didn't have a job and didn't have anywhere to live. So as far as I was concerned, I was gonna stay there, and I signed on because I didn't have a job, and they took ages to sort my benefits out. So I had about 3 or 4 weeks where I didn't have any money. I had no money at all. Had I not been at my parents' house, I don't know what I would have done, because I would have had nothing to live on at all. I had to go to the job centre every 2 weeks, and I had to take in sort of files of what I was doing. And I probably wrote about 20 to 30 job application letters a day. I was not doing anything to try and get, you know, I didn't want to be on benefits because a life on benefits, when they talk about old people sign on and they want to be on benefits, a life on benefits is not an enjoyable life. If you want to work, and I suspect David Cameron and I would differ on this, but the people that I have encountered, the majority of people I meet want to work, because getting up and not having anything to get up for, it was the most spirit-sapping experience of my life, I think. You feel like you're on the outside of society, mostly because every time you turn the telly on, people are basically implying that you're scum because you don't have a job. And if you are trying your hardest to get a job, so if you are, say, you know, writing all these application letters off and getting one reply that says, "Thank you, we've put you on file, we'll give you a ring in about 5 years' time when you've lost the will to live anyway." If you're at that stage, then being told that, you know, what you're doing is not good enough, and you know, you're under 25, so as far as we're concerned, you know, you don't actually need to live in a house, it's not something that I can really truly get on board with. I can see the point that's being made, in that you don't want people, you know, it's, you know, living, you know, necessarily spending their whole lives making no effort at all. But I think the conservative assumption is that everybody that is on benefits, well, the impression that I got from David Cameron today was that everybody on benefits is twagging off, and everyone's got to stop twagging off and sort of get on with it. And the fact of the matter is that I live in Hastings. It's a town on the south coast. Hastings has been spoken of as being up and coming for all of the 29 years of my life, and it's always been up and coming, but it's never actually come up as far as I've experienced. And there's hardly any work. I work out of Hastings, and it's always telling that when I drive out of Hastings, the side of the road where you drive out of Hastings in the morning is always jam-packed, and the side of the roads where you come into Hastings is always empty. And then on the way home, the side of the road where you go back into Hastings is crammed with traffic. And then the road out of Hastings, there's no cars at all. So people are leaving Hastings to find work. And if you're in a position where you're 22 years old, you might not have a car. I think it works on the assumption that, you know, there are plenty of jobs out there and people just need to stop being so uppity with their classics degrees and go and start shack stoves in Sainsbury's, whereas, in fact, you know, there aren't a lot of jobs out there, really.
you mentioned the classics degree there. I mean, that's at the heart of one of the issues, I think. First of all, I think that what hasn't been publicised enough is that these measures that the government is talking about bringing in are really for very long-term unemployed people. They're not for people who have just left university or college or just been most unfortunate to be made redundant or whatever. My understanding, if I've got this right, is that you've got to, you're unemployed for a year, then you go on a work programme scheme, which, if I've read this right, is 2 years. And it's only then if you go, you finish your 2 years on that, so essentially 3 years of unemployment, then you're going to be asked to be mandated to go on these schemes. But just going back to your degree thing, better surely, this is just my view from a much older person, better surely if particularly young unemployed people are trained for jobs that they're capable of undertaking, obviously depending on their skill level, and most importantly though, jobs that have a future. I can't see any point at all these days in allocating hundreds if not thousands of university places, 3 year degree courses in, say, you know, I'm going to say the cliche, media studies.
Fair enough.
There's no jobs. There's no media jobs. Why waste 3 years? And indeed, I would love to spend 3 years studying the classics that you referred to. But unfortunately, in 2013, it's a waste of 3 years.
I think there's a good point there in that in the past, the university and the academic world and sort of jobs were the working world were very different universes. I think now we live in a world where they have become intertwined, and for better or for worse. And of course, the difficulty is that the sort of in the past, we've almost come full circle. In sort of the 1920s and 1930s, I think of all those novels like Brighthead Revisited, with all of the sort of the moneyed classes going to Cambridge and being sent down. The university was a world where basically, if coming from the background I do, which is sort of, you know, we were what used to be classed as C1s, I suppose, is what my parents would have been. So from a fairly sort of semi-detached background, there's no way I could have gone to university in the 20s or 30s. It just wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have opened into our world. And then gradually over time, and then particularly with the new Labour administration, there was this idea that they wanted to open up access to university, which I think was a good thing. And I think that if you want to go to university and learn, then you should be able to. But of course, they then had this target that 50% of the country had to go to university. And that, for me, was missing the point. The point you make about media studies, I think, is correct, in that there are some courses that are not academic courses. I don't want to say some courses are better than others, because I'm not saying that, but you don't, I mean, like, I know someone that did a degree in golf management, and it's like, why do you, I'm not even joking, it's like, why do you have to sit in a lecture theatre for 3 years to learn how to manage a golf course? And what you do is you go and you get yourself a job as an assistant groundskeeper to the golf course. But then, of course, now we live in a world where you have to have a degree for the assistant groundskeeper's role, which means you go to university and you spend 3 years in your golf management course in Lancaster or wherever it is, and then you come back and you earn 12.5 grand as a groundskeeper's assistant, which is what you always would have earned. And you've got this soaring debt to pay off. And so I think I agree with you in the sense that I think that the government lost focus of what university should be for, I think. And I think that there is a place for going and learning. And I really value learning. And I would never want us to live in a world where we didn't have that. And I agree with the idea that everybody should have the chance to experience that. I would hate it to go back to the way it's going as it was in the 20s, which is, you know, only if dad owns a yacht or you know, only if you come from a country park and you have the opportunity to go and broaden your mind. And I think that's right. But equally, I do think it's right. I do think it's we've reached a situation where we are sending people off to university to do degrees when there are no jobs in these things. And I think that... I know that Labour have talked about wanting to encourage more vocational courses and more apprenticeships, and I think that's the way forward, personally. I think that's in terms of getting NEETs, as I believe they're called, not in education, employment or training, that's that handy little acronym, isn't it? In order to deal with them, I think probably the way forward is not just shoving people off to university, it's providing people with opportunities. And I think the problem is that when you're saying, oh, you know, if you haven't got a job for a year, then you have to go on this work scheme for 2 years. I think that people can't take opportunities if they're not there, frankly. And I don't see, certainly in the town I live, an awful lot of opportunities. And I think putting people onto work programmes, I know there was the big work fair case, wasn't there, last year? I can't remember the young lady's name, the Poundland case.
I remember the lady,
the cat something or other, wasn't it? The Poundland lady. And my big problem with work schemes is they're just so degrading. I think, you know, it's one thing, they talk about sort of, you know, layabouts and that sort of thing, but... I just don't see how being made to go and pick up stuff off the floor in Primark for no money 5 days a week is really going to build a sense of cohesion and a sense of people wanting to achieve and a sense of people wanting to contribute to things. I just can't see it, to be honest.
Well, the bit about the sort of cleaning graffiti and picking up litter and so on, the bit about that I found I'm not so keen on is cooking meals for the elderly. That was brought in, and that astonished me because I'm not sure my mother would welcome, you know, a teenager popping round to make her, you know, burnt beans on toast.
How are elderly people on pot noodles? Because that is, I mean, I couldn't cook for myself until I was 26, which, considering I've been in a relationship for 2 years by that point, was a bit of a shame. But, you know, yeah, I wouldn't want to, you know, I don't think any person in their right mind would want something that I cooked them at the age of 19. I didn't want anything I cooked at the age of 19, and it was me that was eating it. So
I'm 58 and I can't cook now.
You're an inspiration to us all, frankly.
This week, if you do wish to seek political upheaval, we need to look no further than the United States, where President Obama today cancelled part of his upcoming trip to Asia in the midst of the US budget battle. Now, Republicans in Congress are demanding that the new Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, I think more generally, is repealed or at least delayed, while the Democrats, involved, including the president, they refuse to concede. Now, I can't quite grasp why Obamacare is widely unpopular in America. Polls suggest a rather large majority are against it. But highlighting the degree of the gap in knowledge in America on this subject is quite worrying, really. Jimmy Kimmel, the late-night TV chat show host, sent out a camera crew on Monday of this week to ask people on the street in Hollywood if they prefer Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, bearing in mind, remember, they're the same thing. And all these people who were interviewed spoke against Obamacare and for the Affordable Care Act. As I say, completely unaware that they're the same thing. Making themselves look rather foolish and highlighting how little people know. Do you think we should encourage a similar scheme to Obamacare over here? Or maybe the other way around, the US should follow the British model of free care for all?
Well, I mean, I have to hold my hands up and say that I'm not always very up on American politics. I'm very up on British politics. And probably my extent of political views in America can be best summed up by The Simpsons, where every time they show the Republican Party headquarters, it's this on this Transylvanian mountain with sort of bats and lightning going off. That's pretty much my kind of knowledge of American politics. I think the point about that, it's just awful, isn't it? The idea that they're telling people, they're offering people options that are the same thing. And people don't know what they are. I think that works over here as well, in that it's always never ceases to amaze me just how ill-informed certain sections of the general public are. I mean, the idea that if you are, that there was that graph going around ages ago, sort of how much money people thought was how many benefits they thought were claimed fraudulently compared to the figure that actually was. The actual figure was something like 0.3 or something, and everyone thought it was sort of in the 20s or the 30s. So I think it's always a bit alarming when you realise that actually most of the country doesn't really know what's going on at any given point. I don't think that's unique to America at all. I think that's pretty much most countries, actually, which sounds cynical and depressed, but I think it's to some extent true. I think as far as the Obamacare model is concerned, well, it's really confusing. I tried to read up on this to see what it actually was, because I was aware that, you know, it was moving away from a sort of a private medical insurance, which has been the American system, towards something that more resembled free or at least government supported healthcare, I think is what it is in reality. And it just it seems I'm not sympathising with the Republicans. Can I just put a big line down that? But equally, I don't know how well conceived it is, because there are it wasn't to me just a clear cut case of it's either free healthcare or it's government supported care. There seem to be a number of different variables. There seem to be a number of different facets to it. And I wasn't convinced at how easy it would be to enforce anyway, although I don't think the Republicans are looking at it that sophisticatedly. God, I sound like George Bush. I don't think they're looking at it that elaborately. I think the Republicans just love a scrap, don't they, the Republicans? They just love being outraged. They are disgusted of Tunbridge Wells on a national level, aren't they?
It is very confusing, though, you're right, because if I understand it correctly, the Republican stance is they believe the Affordable Care Act will mean the loss of thousands of jobs, because I believe the idea behind it is that companies with more than 50 staff will be penalised if they don't provide health coverage for their workers. And so the Republicans say, well, that will lead to loads of businesses closing down because they won't be able to afford it. And that's a very similar argument that we get over here, isn't it, with, for example, pensions, the minimum wage and pensions. You know, we can't afford to pay people the minimum wage because if we do, our business will go under. We can't afford to provide a company pension because our business will go under. That seems to be at the heart of it, but you're right. The health system in America is essentially, it's an open business model. Anybody can provide health care, and it's all different layers of insurance, but it is all based on an insurance model. It's all paid for in one way or another. There is, of course, no real free care, unless, you know, you're talking about somebody, a medic on the street, will give you a bandage or something.
Well, I mean, I have to say that for all of the stresses and strains that the NHS model is over here, I still think that it's something that we can be very proud of, which is why what's happening to the NHS, if you are a supporter of the NHS, which again I believe that the majority of people are, is distressing, frankly, at the moment. And I think actually I can see for once why the Republicans are sort of saying that Obama is this kind of raving socialist, because actually the idea that your employer bears a responsibility for the employee, isn't it? It does hark back to the kind of the days of collective responsibility, really. It is really quite a red idea. And I think that if a business has 50 employees or over, I think it's right. I think the same with the minimum wage and with pensions. I think if you're employing more than 50 people, you're not someone that's flogging dusters door to door, are you, as a one-man band? You are. No. You have a reasonable undertaking. You are making a reasonable amount of money. And if you're not, then your business model or the way you're running your business is at fault. It's not the fault of it's not the fact that you're a small business that means that you're not making any money. And I think that, okay, I used to work for someone who employed five of us, including herself. And in that instance, I can see why she perhaps wouldn't want to provide a pension or healthcare cover. But I think if you're employing 50 people or more, you're probably what's called an SME over here. But I don't think you can really claim to be a struggling small business holder very much. At least I think that you're a reasonable undertaking. And I think if you're going to employ someone, particularly if you're employing someone on a low wage, which my understanding is that Obamacare is kind of weighted depending on how much you're earning. That's one of the things that's taken into account. And sort of the more you're earning, the less your employer contributes, and vice versa. I think that's right. I think it's how it should be.
Means tested, in other words. So as we record this, 800,000 federal employees are on unpaid leave. And by the way, there's absolutely no certainty that they get that back pay, you know, if and when this is resolved. If it goes on for weeks, it could be very troubling indeed.
It's like being on strike without having any choice on being on strike, isn't it? It's like being on strike without strike pay, isn't it, essentially?
That's essentially what it is. An editorial in today's Washington Post says, Americans' respect for their Congress has diminished in recent years, but citizens still expect a minimal level of competence and responsibility. Pay the bills and try not to embarrass us in front of the world. So we'll have to sort of wait and see.
It's all gone a bit Pete Tong, hasn't it? Let's be honest. It's no one's come out of this looking great, not even Obama, have they, really? You do feel like saying... You turn into the world's mum, don't you? Can you not just sit down and play nicely just for a few minutes whilst I sit over here and do my job and pay my taxes? I mean, it's just they look absurd, frankly. And I was an Obama fan and still am to some extent, although he feels a little bit like this is my big political insight of the day. Obama feels a little bit like Azalea Banks, and that he had one really big hit at the beginning that everybody really liked, and everyone thought that it was the most exciting thing they'd ever heard. 212 is the most exciting record I've heard in about 5 years. And then gradually, as nothing else happened and things were put back, Doreen Linsky once said to me on Twitter that he thought Azalea Banks was a great example of a textbook study of how to serially erode your fans' goodwill over a number of years. And I feel that Obama is sort of my Azalea Banks, really. That is what Obama is gradually doing to me. I don't think we're ever going to have another 212, I must admit.
I didn't ever believe I'd hear that analogy today, but I'm glad.
It made sense if you're me. I'm not sure if you're you or any of the parishioners, but hopefully we'll have to suck that one and see when the podcast comes out, I suppose.
I'm teasing. I totally get your drift on that. But it's not just the American press setting a news agenda. It's a phenomenal week for controversial news stories, because over here, back in the UK, the Daily Mail... here we go. Oh, wind yourself up, idiot, because it's the story about the father of the leader of the Labour Party that's been creating its own headlines. Now, we have quite a lot of listeners in America, so I'll just say the British paper over here, the Daily Mail, ran what it calls a critique of Ralph Miliband, and he's the father of the current leader of the Labour Party over here. The Mail argues that Ed Miliband has referred to his father at Labour conferences and at speeches and so on, and they believe then that it's fair game to look at Ralph Miliband's background and beliefs. And the Mail is seemingly basing its criticism on the views held by Miliband Sr., which appear to be, to me, a rather outdated concept of Marxism, but also the rather far-fetched thought that if elected, Ed Miliband will suddenly turn the United Kingdom into a Marxist state, run for the hills.
People's Republic of Aid, it would be.
Yes. Do you think he's right to be angry, Ed Miliband, about what he sees clearly as an attack on his father?
Absolutely, yes. And I think the thing that made him really angry, and can I just say, I think he was on Newsnight originally, but there's a clip that's been doing the rounds on sort of everything online. I think I saw it on The Guardian, of him talking about it. And I don't think I've ever seen him that angry. He was angry to the point where he sort of started laughing in that way that people do when they're just about to punch a traffic warden. That kind of level of being really, really, really cross about something. And I mean, if I was in his position, if someone had written that about my dad, who was dead, that couldn't defend themselves because things that I haven't even said yet, let's be honest. I mean, you know, Ed Miliband's latest speech is perhaps the most left he's made, but it is hardly People's Republic of Ed, is it? I mean, it's not Michael Foot, put it that way. So they're attacking someone's dead father for something that their son hasn't even said yet. And I think the thing that really got Ed Miliband cross, and I think the thing that's got a lot of people, and interestingly, I think a lot of Daily Mail readers as well, I think the Daily Mail has rather uncharacteristically totally misjudged its audience here, because a lot of people, I think, read the Daily Mail without necessarily being as right wing as the Daily Mail, but they kind of, you know, they buy it for the telly paper and they kind of the sidebar of shame on the website and they go along with it and sometimes, you know, it reflects their views. But I think a lot of people would be shocked by just how unpleasant it was and how, I mean, Edmund and Bans made this thing about how there was a picture of his father's grave with a pun on how he was a grave socialist, which just seems beyond the pale. It's just so rude, isn't it? I know that seems like an understated way of putting it, but, you know, it's just so rude. And the idea that they said you can have a right of reply, and I thought that you know, I am a fan of Evelyn Band. I'll, you know, perhaps in a minority, but I am a fan. And but even if I hadn't been a fan, I thought that his article that he wrote in response was very well reasoned and very sensible and pretty rational, really, considering that, you know, 6 million people have read these people trashing his father. I thought he was pretty calm about it, really, and made the point that, you know, how can someone that fought in the Navy for Britain, which was dealt with in one sentence of Geoffrey Levy's article, how can they hate Britain and Britain saved his life? And he made a number of really good points and said, look, you know, he said that he understood that if you're the leader of the Labour Party, if you're the leader of any political party, you're always going to get a bit of a thrashing in the press because it comes with the territory. And that's just, you know, that's how it is. That's what you have to realise there's going to be debate when you go into that as a career. But, you know, his dead father is something else entirely different. You know, he's not in the public domain. You know, he's not alive. And the idea that they feel that's acceptable to do is appalling, I think. And the idea that then having published his right to reply, they then published the original piece next to it with "We Repeat" and that lovely picture of him and his dad when Ed was a teenager, which really upset me, actually, I must admit. The idea that they've used this lovely family photo that God knows where they got it from, but they've used this photo and for this fairly sort of, you know, bilious attack underneath, and then put, oh, and by the way, he did hate Britain and he's evil. I mean, you, again, another metaphor. You feel like, you know, they're that drunk in the pub car park that just won't let it go, will they? You know, everyone is trying to lead them away from what is obviously a very bad idea, and they've just done it again. And it shows that for all of the criticisms of Ed Miliband, they must be doing something right to have wound up Paul Dacre in the Daily Mail to the degree that they slag off your dead father and then refuse to apologise and slag him off again. They're a bit pinged up, aren't they, to use my expression? And I can see why Eddie's pinged up, frankly. And I think that he will come out of this looking better than the Daily Mail, frankly, which is you know, a bit of a win for Labour, I think.
I think he will, and I was about to describe it as an own goal for the Daily Mail, and then I thought that's too feeble.
It is. I mean, I see your point. Sorry, I just started talking and didn't stop, so I'm sorry about that. But I can see. Yeah, I think an own goal is it's certainly an own goal. If it depends how cynical you want to be. If there was some level of cohesion with the Conservative Party, which I don't know if there was or if there wasn't, but they...
I don't think so, because Cameron and Clegg have both come out, you know, in support of Ed Miliband.
Yes, they have, although I noted how Cameron said, oh, I haven't read the article, and someone made the comment on Twitter, oh, so you're at your party conference and you haven't read any papers in the morning and you don't have any access to the internet or a telephone. I mean, I can see, you know, he did come out in support of him, and Craig did, and that was right to do so, but equally I'm sort of slightly cynical about that. But if we sort of take the people out of it and just say that perhaps the Tory party and the Daily Mail perhaps have a broadly similar agenda or have some level of similar sort of interests, it's a huge own goal for the Tory party, because I think it was it Gabby Hinsliff, someone said, one of the media outlets, that the two biggest, it might have been Andrew Sparrow in The Guardian, that the two biggest stories of the Conservative Party conference both involve Ed Miliband, and one of them wasn't even political. I mean, everybody made an attempt to derail the Labour conference last week with the Damien McBride stuff, when in fact, you know, compared to, you know, Ed Miliband's energy bill speech sort of pretty much blew all of that stuff out of the water. Whereas this week, although we've had some coverage on the news, it's pretty much been dwarfed by this Daily Mail thing. And I think, you know, the Tories are probably going to be crosser than Labour about that, to be honest.
Perhaps so, but I do find the reaction of some people on the left, I think, whilst not quite an own goal, they're passing it back to the goalkeeper rather too quickly, and he might, because it's troubling that people are calling, for example, people are calling for companies to stop stocking the Daily Mail. I noticed a friend of Alistair Campbell and his wife was tweeting last night and saying that British Airways should stop giving away free copies of the Daily Mail on all its flights. I don't know if you saw that. And I was thinking, well, guess why British Airways do that? I imagine it's because it's popular and people want to read it. So I don't think... Also, there's a troubling edge to me when people start wanting to censor a newspaper and say, oh, don't stock it, you know, don't give people the choice. But, you know, we can argue against it like we are now and say it was intolerably rude and it was an awful thing to do. But I still wouldn't want to sort of be blocking somebody's way into a newsagent and say, you can't go in there if you're going to buy the Daily Mail.
I think I agree to some extent. I mean, we could go off into another direction and talk about the campaign to ban page three here, which I think is a similar sort of thing. I mean, I think I don't think page three has a place in society, and I don't want to see page three in newspapers. I don't read The Sun anyway, but there are a lot of things about page three that troubles me. But I think that's a slightly different issue, I think, to the idea of whether or not you should let places stock the Daily Mail or stop them. There's a campaign actually going on via Facebook that started sort of locally to me, but seems to have spread a bit, called Cover Up the Hate Mail. And basically what you do is you go into your supermarket and you know they have those racks of newspapers, those sort of square things. You pick another paper up and you put it on top of the Daily Mail and then you walk off. And
I quite like that
as a campaign because someone then walks along, the person in the green jacket, if it's at Asda's or wherever, comes along and picks it off 10 minutes later. But you have perhaps made a difference, because if five people walk up and go, oh, there's no Daily Mails today, I mean, admittedly, they're not going to go, oh, I'll have a Guardian instead, because people don't work like that. But equally, you know, I don't like the mail. I think it's because it is so unpleasant, and I think that this is you know, the peak of the mail's unpleasance, I think. But when, you know, I think quite a lot of the tone of it does seem to be built on fear and unpleasantness, and for that I don't like it. But equally, I think I'm inclined to agree with you that the way to go forward with things is to not by banning things, but just by showing them up. It's like when the BBC tried to ban Nick Griffin from being on Question Time. Or rather, they didn't ban him, they had him on Question Time, but they decided to make it an immigration special. To me, that wasn't the right attitude. What you do if you want to show the BNP for what they are, you put them on a panel and you ask them about politics. And guess what? They don't know anything, because all they know is you know, the race issues. And I think UKIP, but to some extent, at the bum fight that was the UKIP conference the other week, showed to some extent that's the same thing. And I think if you give them enough rope, as your friends in that band said, I mean, you know, if you want to show something up for what it is, you know, be better than them. Don't ban them, just be better than them. And I think Ed Miliband was better than the Mail in his response, and that's what made them so cross, I think. I think he showed them up and embarrassed them by that very reasonable response, and I think that's what made them so angry. And so my attitude would be, don't stop places from stocking the Mail, just stock other stuff that's better as well.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I think, to summarise a bit, I think that if anything's learned from it for the Daily Mail, is that they're readers, hopefully, you know, do have a line that they'll draw. Yes. And while they're happy to go along with the sort of focus on which celebrity has the most cellulite and a bit of BBC bashing and, you know, those pictures of vaguely famous people in bikinis that,
Does anybody know who they are? I've never heard of them.
I
worked out the other day, I don't know any famous person in America under the age of 40. I just don't know who anyone is.
No, me too. Well, we can't keep the Daily Mail quiet, and we don't want to, as we've just discovered. But last Friday, Radio 1 tried an experiment that did lead to some silence, as the daytime lineup of disc jockeys were left without access to a microphone and only able to communicate through Twitter. And this was part of their Even More Music Month.
They always have to have a brand, don't they? They had the reboot the other month, I think. I get confused. Yeah. It's like all those indie subgenres of the 80s and the 90s. I get confused. What's shoegaze? What's twee? I it's probably wrong, given my background, that I'm talking in that terms. But like different genres of jazz, hard bop and bebop and soft bop and post bop. I feel that way about Radio 1 rebranding exercises, I must admit.
Well, I'm not a listener to Radio 1, which probably no great surprise, but it just seemed a really bizarre idea to me that you would spend a day where you kind of give all your presenters the day off, and then they just can only communicate through words through the rather limited medium of Twitter.
Carry on.
No, go on. I was just going to ask you if there's any value in it for the listeners of Radio 1.
Well, my assumption, I mean, I drive to work for about 40 minutes there and back. I don't listen to Radio 1. I worked in an office for about 4 or 5 months at the end of last year and the beginning of this year where we have to listen to Radio 1 every day. And it was a dispiriting experience, to put it mildly. There's large swathes of music that I can never listen to ever again, that I didn't even want to listen to in the first place particularly. But I'm not really a habitual Radio 1 listener, but I tend to have 2 or 4 on in the car, but I was flicking between channels on the way home, and I realised that this is what they were doing, and I assumed they'd all got on some away day or something, you know, they had some training exercise, and they just kind of left Radio 1 on CPU, you know, when they have computer games and you play the computer. I thought that's what they'd done, and then it turned out it was part of this Even More Music. There's something going on at Radio 1. They're obviously, I think Bain Cooper is now the controller, and there was talk last year, and I think Joe Rivers on Ripcord wrote something about this, about how they were trying to make the playlist more guitar band based, and they were trying to rebrand Radio 1 as sort of almost like a real music station again, because I think they felt that it swung from the sort of the Matty Bannister era of the 90s, where they threw everything out and it was sort of very Britpoppy and quite alternative at times for a while, and then it had gradually gone back to sort of being populicious. And I think they felt that they want to get it back onto this sort of more credible thing. So this is why they're trying to say, oh, here's real music and stuff. On the one hand, it made me realise that quite a lot of daytime presenters are quite annoying, and it was quite nice not to hear anything from them, I must admit. Which then led me to think, who is Radio 1 for? The reason why that they're trying to rebrand is that it's always been a big bone in contention that under the BBC Trust, the Radio 1's broadcasting audience is meant to be 18 to 30, I think, or 32 possibly. And the average listener age of Radio 1 at one point was something like 36. So it was not fulfilling its role under the BBC Trust. So they were trying to bring the listenership down. I'm 29, which means I should be within Radio 1's kind of listening band. And nothing on it interests me. I mean, not even Zane Lowe, not even... I mean, I grew up listening to stuff like Lamac and Peel and stuff like that, and there's nothing like that at all now. And my view of it was that it basically showed how inessential a lot of daytime Radio 1 DJs are, by and large. Not a lot of them say a lot of any value, it has to be said. If you look at their daytime lineup, Scott Mills is probably the best of a fairly poor bunch. If you've got Nick Grimshaw, Fern Cotton, Scott Mills, what's that awful bloke that's on at Drive Time, Greg James, everything they say, when I heard him again on the Monday when he was back, everything just sounded so vacuous. Even my equivalents when I was younger, Joe Wiley gets a kicking from a lot of quarters, but I didn't feel she was as bland and vacuous as the people that are on Radio 1 now. And I felt that it was a bit of an own goal, really, because back to our own goal theme, that it was trying to show off the fact that, you know, we're all about music on Radio 1. And actually what it made me think was, why aren't you all about music? Why have you got these stupid people telling me stuff that I don't care about, that's banter in inverted commas all day? Why aren't you doing more within your remit to serve different people with different tastes within your remit of 18 to 34, rather than a very narrow part of their remit? I think it shows that Radio 1 could do a lot more than what they're doing.
Well, you see, it's really interesting you say that, because you've confounded my theory, and you are within their age range. So, you know, it's particularly prescient that you say so, because I assumed, clearly wrongly, that it's the personalities of the presenters that keep the concept of pop music radio going. Because if I want non-stop music, I can just go to Spotify or... Yeah. You know, pull up my own playlist. But from what you're saying, they're pretty twerpish, these people, on there anyway. So, but if they had engaging personalities and had the style of a Le Mac or a Peel, would you think then maybe there, you know, there is a place?
Yes, I think so. I think actually Six get it more right than One do, in that Six are heavily music based, and I think that probably you get a lot more. You get a lot more music on Six than I think you do on One, perhaps. I noticed that the most music you ever got in a row on One was sometimes 11 o'clock in the morning. They used to do one track before the top of the hour and then two tracks afterwards, which essentially gave you three in a row. And that was the most music that you ever got consecutively on Radio One. And Six seemed to be far more music heavy. I don't count the tracks per hour, but it's exactly the sort of nerdy thing that I would do. And I think that if you did, you'd find Six was a lot more music heavy. But having said that, because Six have bigger personalities, I think, and more experienced sort of old, not exactly old hands, but people like, you know, Laverne, I'm just trying to think, and Radcliffe and Marconi and Lamac and you know, and their daytime lineup, I think that they can do more with less, if you see what I mean. You know, I think that Lauren Laverne probably covers more ground in about 4 minutes worth of talking than, you know, Grimshaw and co on Radio One could probably do in half an hour. I just think they have more. When I say they have more about them, it's that thing, isn't it? This X factor that we hear so much about. And I just don't feel that anybody on daytime Radio One really has X factor. I don't feel that, you know, compared to their past rosters of DJs. The fact of the matter is that most past Radio 1 DJs are applying their wares elsewhere. I listened to Simon Mayo on Radio 2 Drive Time, having listened to him in the mornings as a teenager, and you know, I'd rather listen to him on Radio 1, and I don't know if it's just me not necessarily having the ordinary taste of someone in their 20s, or whether it is just that they are very... I mean, I hated Chris Miles. I loathed him. But at the same time, he had a personality. He wasn't someone like Fern Cotton that turned up in a Motorhead T-shirt they bought from Topshop talking about how they met Pete Doherty the other week. Oh, my God, it was so amazing. I just want to break things. Or Nick Grimshaw talking about, you know, what skinny jean fashion party he's been to the night before, which means that he can't get any of his cues, but never mind. And as someone that, you know, would ideally like to make a career in radio, to hear people not that bothered messing it up every day is making me disgusted of Tunbridge Wells.
I tell you what's going to be jolly interesting is when the Rajar stats come out, or any other stats before that, because how worrying for the Radio 1 management if listener figures went up.
I kept it on for the whole journey. I never do that with Radio 1, and because I found it interesting, because it was a charty countdown type thing. I love those things, because I was interested to hear what the next record was going to be, because I didn't know.
Ah, well, I think some interesting conversations will have to go on, because it was like, listen, Grimmy, great job and all that, but the listeners prefer it when you're not here.
Well,
it
was Ronan Keating, isn't it? He says it best when he says nothing at all, which is not ideal if talking on the radio is your living, is it, really? I don't know, just as a sort of a side point and a recommendation, I can't remember exactly. I think it's Simon Garfield has written a number of interesting books. He's just written one called Off the Map, I think, about sort of mapping, and he wrote one called Just My Type about fonts before that. He wrote a book years ago called True Adventures in Radio One, where he was somehow allowed, I don't know who signed this off, allowed him fly-on-the-wall access in the two-year period when Bannister came in and shook it all up and sacked everybody and got access to everybody. And interviewed everybody and wrote a book and I think made a documentary about it. And it's brilliant. It's, if you're interested in radio and what goes on at Radio 1, it's a fantastic insight. But Zoe Ball makes a comment in it that they used to live and die by Raja stats. She said that Raja Day was you know, proper everyone queuing up in the toilets type day. It was awful. And the thought of, you know, whilst I've just spent 10 minutes flagging him off, being near Grimshaw and waiting outside the headmaster's office to see on Rajah Day, which is always a big thing anyway, to see, you know, yes, people prefer it when you're not actually talking about anything. Is, well, I do feel a bit sorry for them, I must admit, although they should probably talk less about celebrity parties, maybe. That might be a hint.
Well, that's one very good reason why Radio 1 doesn't trouble my ears, if that's all that goes on, I have to say.
I mean, this is my, you know, I could be, you know, not exactly quoting verbatim here, but that is my general bad-tempered opinion of Radio 1.
Yeah, I suspect you're right. From radio to television and onto our television reviews for this week, we watched two programmes in a row. We sort of University Challenge. University Challenge is one of those shows that always seemed to be there. Mm. Indeed, if you were born in the UK after 1962, it has always been there.
Is that how long it's been on?
Yeah, 1962
it was
over here.
Bamber Gascoigne, wasn't it, originally?
Bamber Gascoigne was the rather gentle and professorial kind of figure. He was the quizmaster from 1962 to 87. Mm. Then there was a hiatus of 7 years before the BBC breathed sort of new life into it, and the rather more confrontational Jeremy Paxman took charge. Although the format is unaltered, the style is rather more speedy and come on than the Bamber days. But anyway, having watched University Challenge this week with a reviewing hat on, Juliet, did it make you want to dash off back to university and get to Freshers Week at Cardiff or Exeter?
Firstly, can I just say, I found it quite hard to review, because like you say, it's always been there, and I usually watch it. I mean, I watch few programmes on television habitually, but it's the sort of thing where, if it's on, then, and quite often I'm on Twitter, and my entire timeline, because obviously this is the kind of person I follow, fills up with people going, "No, you idiot, of course it's Cuba," and stuff like that, and then I think, oh, I suppose I'd better watch that, and so in that sense, I found it quite hard. It's a bit like trying to, it's sort of reviewing my own arms, really. It's just kind of, it's something that's just there, but I think the fact is that I thought Paxo had softened a bit, actually, because I've seen some before where he is really leery, and I thought, actually, whilst he was a bit come on, he didn't seem as contemptuous when they got it wrong, which I thought was I think someone might have had a quiet word, really, along the lines of, it's very easy to know the answer when you've got it written on a card in your hand, but when you're a 19-year-old studying, at Loughborough or whatever, it's not quite as simple. I mean, I think it works. It's a format that works. I think it works better for being quick, actually, for all that Paxo is confrontational. It does, in a way, build a kind of excitement, really. And I approach it a bit like a sport, in that I can never watch a football match. I can never stay neutral watching a football match. I always end up cheering on one side. I just can't do it. And I did that with University Challenge, and I was rooting for Cardiff from the off, because they had a couple of girls on them. They all looked pretty sensible. And I thought all of Exeter looked like they'd been stuffed, frankly. I thought it was a bit disconcerting, really. If I didn't know who they were, I would have said they were Oxbridge, because they were all a bit tweedy. And there was that one that, bless him, just answered every single question wrong for about 15 minutes. I mean, I enjoy watching it, because I think it's quite fun. And also, there was a lovely moment where one of the Welsh girls, what was it she said? She said Dante Gabriella Rossetti very quickly in a Welsh accent, and that for me was worth watching the programme for alone. Like you said with my metaphor earlier, it wasn't something I thought I'd see, I'm glad I can never unsee it. Frankly, I thought that was good. I mean, it's a quiz programme that they've changed the format slightly, but not. Totally beyond what it was originally. It works well. People seem to like it. People go in for it at universities. And there was the Trimble controversy, wasn't there, a few years ago, where they then sort of changed the rules and stopped 44-year-olds doing PhDs going on it, which I think is right, to be fair. Yeah. I think, and they always tell you what their average age is now. Although I noticed last night they said Cardiff's average age was 29, but there were clearly three of them were about 12, and then there was there was that guy that was perhaps a little more august, shall we say,
a little bit more mature.
Yes, who was in a sweatshirt, as they invariably are, and sort of doing his thing. I thought it was a low scoring edition, but I enjoy it. I think it's quite good, in that they pitch it slightly easier than they used to. You can sort of it's still hard enough that, you know, people rejoice on Twitter if they get more than 10 right. If I get more than 10 right, I start looking online for courses to apply to, because I think I'm probably back in the game. I mean, I'm a fan. I think it's a good program. It works for me.
I wonder if the lady from Cardiff that you mentioned was the same one that I noticed. It was Miss Caputo of Cardiff. Because
she had a lot of hair.
She had a lot of hair. That's her. Yeah. That's her. But she exhibited such joy when she got a starter question correct. She sort of jumped around in a chair. Yeah. And I warmed to her immediately.
Yeah, that was lovely, wasn't it? The blonde girl always looked quite surprised when she got one right. I could see them presenting TV shows together. They were a good foil. I mean, having watched Bake Off last night with Mel and Sue, it's going to wear out eventually, aren't they? They could do worse than those two University Challenge girls.
Yeah, bring in Miss Caputo and the other lady sitting next to her.
They've got telly experience, clearly. So yeah, they've got through to the next round, so they'll have more telly experience. So I like this. We're fixing things, aren't we?
Give them the gig.
Fixing television.
Yes. Well, I think Paxman, in a way, is ideal as quizmaster, because his elocution is excellent, isn't it? Although he yells the questions rather, he's so easy to understand, which is, of course, vital when the teams can't see the questions. But I noted the same thing as you. I made a little bullet point to mention this, that previous seasons of this, I found very unlikable, that habit of sneering at incorrect answers. And I noticed he only did it once last night. It was David Lloyd George, he said. It was rather in the manner of, I thought, that big cheese in the workhouse when Oliver Twist comes up and asks for more and more. You know, he said, David Lloyd George.
I got the, you young people, you know nothing vibe. That was what I was getting off that. But yes, I did spot that. That was the only point at which, you know, he made someone feel stupid. And I hate the idea that if someone goes to the effort of auditioning to get on a telly program and then turning up and giving you an answer to the question, having buzzed in for it, I think that's a bit off, really, to be so contemptuous.
So I would enjoy it a little bit more if it had that's a little gentler quality, more like the Great British Bake Off that you referred to.
Exactly.
Sort of, you know, where you can sit back and not know that, and know that people aren't going to get yelled at. But that was University Challenge. And then that was followed on Monday. And I get the feeling you really enjoyed this program, because I think you sent me an email in the middle.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Monday, 8:30 on BBC Two, Tom Kerridge's Proper Pub Food. And Tom Kerridge and his wife Beth, they actually run a Michelin-starred pub just up the road from me in Marlow.
I did wonder if it was your part of the world, actually.
It is my part of the world. I must say, I've never met them, and I've never been in their pub, so don't worry.
I was going to say, thank you for that. That's reassuring.
Yes. Now, appearances on Saturday Kitchen and the Great British Menu have led to this new series of his own for Tom Kerridge on BBC Two, as I just said, Tom Kerridge's Proper Pub Food. Interesting character, this Tom Kerridge. He became caught up in a controversy last year when he joined in abuse of a customer on Twitter who had posted a kind of lukewarm review of a meal at one of his friend's restaurants. And it wasn't very tasteful, I have to say. He managed to avoid any four-letter word tirades on his BBC Two show on Monday.
He did well, I thought, at that. That was a skill, I think.
Yes. Will he be trying his chicken in a basket or his barbecue maple cake?
I will not be doing anything else again involving Tom Kerridge if I can possibly avoid it, to summarise my feelings on this.
Oh, right. So, yes, clearly, as your email that you sent to me alluded to your view, I was thinking, if the tenor of the programme was how to cook pub classics in your own home. And I was thinking, why? If I want pub food, I go to a pub.
Exactly. And if I want to cook something nice at home, I'll cook something nice. And if I want to eat cornflakes in my pyjama bottoms, not that I ever do that, obviously. But, you know, I agree. It's like, if you want pub food, pop to a pub. The chances are you're not going to be able to buy the ingredients for his pub food much cheaper than you would pay in a pub anyway, to be honest. Even if you're going gastro, they're more affordable than restaurants, because that's the point of gastro pubs. That is the whole... It was. I can't believe he runs a gastro pub, because it seemed like he didn't understand the concept of the gastro pub at all, which, considering he runs on with two Michelin stars, was a surprise, frankly.
It's really expensive as well. I looked up the menu
today.
And good grief. You know, all the main courses are sort of around the £30 mark.
And that's not factoring into the fact that, you know, you've got to pay for a taxi to hospital once you've had a heart attack through eating most of it, really.
His barbecue beef ribs were looked like.
I felt that it was summed up by the fact that he said, "Oh, I'm going to make a salad, but I want a proper salad." And I'll talk about how offensive the semantics of the whole program were in a minute. But he said, "I want a salad." He made a salad with bread and dripping in it, which is not my definition of a salad, really.
Doesn't feature in many people's idea of healthy eating, it has to be said.
I don't want to get into the whole sort of criticising people in their appearance thing, but he wasn't a small chap, was he?
And
I felt there was some correlation between what he was recommending to eat and sort of how he was. And I think the thing that offended me, because I would actually say I found this programme offensive. I would definitely put it in that bracket, because the thing that I found offensive about it was I just felt like it was trying. That was the thing. It was trying in every sense of the word for me. But my opinion on anything is, if something's having to tell you that it is something, then it's not, if you see what I mean. If something is trying to tell you what it is, it shouldn't have to tell you what it is. It should just be what it is, and then you'll know what it is. And he was obviously trying to do the Jamie Oliver thing of being a bit matey and a bit laddie and, whoa, it's all right to eat a salad if you're a bloke. He actually said at one point, he described a blokey salad, which I didn't know that food had gender. I didn't know that it was like the Singing Grapes and the Muppets. I didn't know that food had that kind of property. And it was just, you know, everything was amazing. I counted how many amazings he said at one point, and I got to 18 and the battery on my iPhone died where I was making the notes, and that is a true story. That's how often he said it, and everything was amazing. This, a proper lush, literally, it was... He said the fish was literally caught this morning. And I found myself turning into this kind of Paxo-type figure. What, as opposed to metaphorically you caught that fish this morning? And it was almost like, at least when Smashy and Nighty did the whole literally thing, there was some level of self-awareness and parody about that. Whereas this was... It didn't have anything to say. It said the same words over and over again. It didn't really have anything of note. It treated me like an idiot. I mean, he said they used the phrase chillo relaxo and take a chill pill, which is I think the most blood pressuring phrase that I have, really. That is the thing to say to me if you want me to punch you, by and large. And he talked about no fork food. And it's like, why does everything have to have a name? Why are you having to package everything so that I'll understand it? I get the concept that you can pick it up and eat it with your hand. That is something I can understand. I don't need you to give it a label to me. I just felt like it was treating me, the viewer, with just utter contempt by having to jazz everything up, the ubiquitous Arctic Monkeys style soundtrack. I mean, the idea that it was trying to, you know, make cooking sexy and fun and work. And it's like, if I watch a cooking program, it's because I like what they've said is going to be on it, and I want to know how to cook. And I watch Nigel Slater, and he tells me how to cook. I notice how they didn't tell you any of the amounts to put in stuff, which means, where they said, you go on the BBC Food website. What happens in reality is you go on the BBC Food website, they've got four recipes there, and they go, you have to go and buy the book, and which you know, is £20 in your local Sainsbury's or whatever. It wouldn't be, I suppose, because that's Jamie Oliver, but, you know, wherever you pay your money. I just thought the whole thing just sort of stunk, frankly. I just thought it wasn't... It was trying to be something, and it was nothing, was what I felt about it, really.
Like you, I loathed every living second of it.
I'm so glad. If you'd have said then, actually, I thought he was really good, and it was really... I would have cried, I think, if you'd said that you'd liked it.
I absolutely hated it. And also, I simply don't believe people make these things after watching them on television. It's probably why they give up telling the ingredients. I think people just like to watch the making of the process.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it was beautifully filmed, and you know, in the sense that it was like long lingering shots on, liquids being poured. Yeah, it was all.
The cameraman earned his money, but I don't think anybody else did, frankly.
But I tell you what, though, and this will probably get him very angry on Twitter if he gets to hear I said this, his kitchen could do with a bit of a clean.
It was not a great advert. That would have got a 3 on the food hygiene scale, if that, wouldn't it, really? I mean, my local chippy's got 4, and I think that was cleaner than Tom Kerridge's kitchen.
I know, that would worry me immensely. The final note I made about the Tom Kerridge show was that at the very end they said, next time, and I put down a little bit of paper here, well, not for me, no, next time for me. That was Tom Kerridge's proper pub food. It was directed by Sarah Myland for Outline Productions. And before that, we were talking about University Challenge, of course, presented by Jeremy Paxman, and that was produced by Irene Daniels. Now, Juliet, before we get to our last feature, the time has flown by.
I have probably said more than enough for most of your parishioners, but yes, do continue.
Well, if they haven't had enough, tell us how and where we can hear even more of you.
Well, we
haven't heard enough of this one.
I was going to say, if you have that level of patience, well firstly, I applaud you, frankly. And secondly, I do this weekly show on an internet-based station called ARFM. ARFM, sort of, to tell you a little bit about it, ARFM is basically a sort of a hard rock and metal station. Hence why my show, which is called Indie Wonderland, I'm sort of like a very low-rent John Peel on this station. I can do what I want for a couple of hours every week. It's Thursdays from 7 till 9 is when I go out live usually, and that's at www.arfm.co.uk, and there's a mixed cloud as well. I just, you know, do sort of John Peel-ish sort of stuff, really. I just play anything that interests me, which we stretch the banner of indie sort of to fairly elastic degrees most weeks, I think. The station itself is a heavy rock and metal station, and my show is you know, this kind of weird little indie thing with adverts in the middle of it for various heavy rock tours and bands, which are often, I probably shouldn't be saying this, but they're often the funniest part of the programme, it has to be said. So that's what I do, really, and I enjoy it. I mean, I don't have any. Obviously, everybody, like lots of people in my position, my dream would be to be Six Music. But equally, I'm more than happy broadcasting from somebody's spare room, which is what I'm essentially doing on this. That, you know, that it's I have been much how I am this evening, I think, really, except with more tunes, which is probably much improved. Let's face it.
And you unlike the people on Radio 1, you engage in sort of two ways, not only sort of telling people what you're playing and what's going on and so on, but during the show you kind of live tweet with the listeners
I
as well.
I do,
don't you?
Yes.
You have a kind of bit of a gang.
Yes, I mean, we use a hashtag. I decided I was going to use Twitter fairly early on because you know, I really like Twitter. And I started off, my first station, the reason I fell into this is that I was broadcasting on Hastings Rock, which is my local station that's on for a month a year as a sort of a one of these limited licences. And I put a little bit on Twitter about how I was on. And some people that I knew from Twitter, and primarily from the Word website, as it then was, started tweeting along and said that they liked this and that they liked that and that was good and, or could I play this? And I loved it. I loved the idea that if you're sat in a room by yourself, which is always how I broadcast, it can be quite difficult to gauge sort of how, what's going on really and how it's going out, and to be able to engage on Twitter and to see what people like and what they don't like and stuff like that. And also just to have people mucking about and being silly and making daft jokes. I love it. That's, I really like that. So, and I think if I was listening, I love the idea of having a gang, you know, having this kind of little indie kid gang. And so I really do try to encourage that because I get a lot out of it. And I think that by using the hashtag Team Wonderland, which would also seem is a set of Japanese cheerleaders and a nightclub in Maidstone. So occasionally you get the hashtag does not make a lot of sense. I think there's a lot of Japanese kids here that are going, what? PJ who? What's going on? Or people in Maidstone nightclub going, what do you mean we book Bell and Sebastian next week? I mean, I think there's sometimes hashtag confusion, But I encourage people to tweet it on. We do have a Facebook, but equally Twitter seems to be the sort of the home for it, really. And I've had this ongoing project. Things that you think are a good idea at Christmas when you've had a drink and then you realise you have to spend a year running them on a radio show. The A to Z of indie, alt rock and miscellaneous, thus being fairly open about my elastic, you know, definition of indie, where the first week I played an hour's worth of bands beginning of the day who I felt deserved a place in the Pantheon. And then I said to my listeners, who have I missed out? Who do you think I should have played that I didn't? Can you tweet me or email me and let me know? And everyone seems to do it. And so 1 week is my week for an hour, and then the next week is the listeners' week for an hour. And I don't think I've ever had a week where I haven't had enough contributions to make an hour. And it's sort of almost like crowd sharing, really, and that's really sort of taken off. And I often say that most weeks I probably couldn't do the show without my listeners, really, because you know, they provide the thing. So I think, yeah, you're spot on, I hope, and that I really want it to feel like a gang. I don't want it to feel that, you know, obviously, as I frequently say, I quote Bart Simpson saying, my bubble, my rules, when people get a bit antsy about things on Twitter. But equally, you know, I want people to feel it's something they can be a part of, really, which sounds very, very much like a BBC Radio 1 middle manager, I'm sure. But I hope that you know, that I'm at least trying to achieve that, rather than, you know, I don't usually say I want everyone to be a part of this. Like we said earlier, I'm trying not to tell people that I am stuff. I'm just trying to be stuff. And hopefully people like that, I think.
Well, let's keep the musical theme running, because now we'll turn to our closing feature, which is the pretend iPod, where we choose a piece of music and Juliet and I will tell you why we like it, and then it gets bunged onto a ginormous playlist.
It is huge, isn't it? I was trying to battle through it, and there is loads, isn't it?
There's 150, 160, I don't know, something like that. But what track are you adding to
I love the fact that, well, first I said to you earlier, I love the fact that when it was announced that I was going to be on this, there was I think small's overstating it, but there was a little level of excitement on Twitter, which made me feel a little bit like a celebrity, which, you know, I'm wearing a jumper with a hole in it. I'm quite clearly, you know, I wouldn't even qualify for the sidebar of shame, would I, frankly? There was speculation as to, from listeners of Indie Wonderland, as to what tracks I would pick, and there was speculation in some quarters that I would pick two PJ Harvey tracks. Controversially, I'm not going to do that. And actually, doubly controversially, indeed. I mean, I can't speak for next week, spoiler. But equally, you know, I thought what I was going to pick, and I thought I was going to pick Her Jazz by Huggy Bear, which I've written about for Rocking Vicar before, and you very kindly said that I could basically regurgitate that. But we couldn't find it on Spotify, so you said, why don't you pick something else instead? So I'm going to be doubly controversial. I'm picking a pop record. I'm not picking an indie record or a cool record at all. I heard this song, like pop, like Radio 1 and modern pop music, I always seem to come to things 2 months after everybody else knows about them. That's generally how I conceive the world. And I heard this thing, I'd heard a lot of talk about this record called I Love It by Icona Pop, I think they're called. They're a Swedish girl duo. And I thought, well, I'll listen to this, and because everyone was raving about it. Sort of all the big sites like Pop Justice were sort of going on about how good it was. And I thought I'd like to hear it. And actually, it did a lot of the same things for me as Her Jazz by Huggy Bear did, in that it's a record by women. It's quite up. It's quite loud. I mean, it's really loud. For a pop song, it's quite lairy, really. I mean, I think it's guitars and synths. And it's quite short. And the whole message of it is basically, you know, I don't care what you say, I'm going to do what I want. And the message of it is that there's a relationship that's broken up, and she's thrown his stuff down the stairs, and she's driven his car into a bridge, and I don't care, I love it, is the chorus. And it's not, you know, as my dad always dismisses modern indie records with, oh, I bet Cole Porter wishes he'd written this. I mean, I suspect that my dad would probably say this about I Love It by Icona Pop, but I love the fact that it's just, you know, what sits out pop music, really. And I think there's a great snobbery, I think, that, you know, this argument like, oh, Girls Aloud aren't one of the great groups of the last decade because they don't play their own instruments and they don't write their own songs. And I just find that so redundant, really. To me, you know, great music is great music. And I would hate the idea that, you know, I hate people to think that because I present this indie show that I'm kind of stuck in this indie ghetto. Because let's face it, a lot of Britpop music was unlistenable. Quite a lot of the lower tier Weller and Weller alikes were pretty trying, really. And I think, you know, I wanted to pick something. A lot of the pretend iPod is brilliant, but equally, I wanted to pick something that was just a fantastic pop record, because I think there is a place for it. And it has the same attitude as Huggy Bear. It is what it is, and it is largely a women-based record, and it makes you want to jump up and down and do stuff. And that, for me, is a great record.
I hadn't realised quite what a worldwide hit it had been. It was only after I saw it was on the running order that you picked it.
It was ginormous, wasn't it? I mean, I don't know how I missed this. I really don't.
Well, me too. I hadn't realised who it was by. I have to admit, I'd heard it because it was everywhere about a year ago. Mm. But I didn't know who the band were or even the title of it, but I knew of it. But, it was number one. How I missed it, I don't know, because it was number one in the UK. But number seven in the US as well. It hit all over the world. I was just looking it up. Sweden, Australia, Canada, Germany. It's, top three everywhere around the world. So, but then I did notice that, as so many of these sort of acts do, they've had three singles since.
They've done nothing.
Which... haven't troubled the charts anywhere at all.
We won't hear from them again, and it doesn't matter. I mean, we're never going to hear anything again from Wigfield, but it doesn't stop Saturday Night being a good record for what it was. And equally, we're all waiting for Statman John's follow-up album that's never going to turn up, isn't it? I mean, not everybody has to be a 12-album Springsteen type, do they? Sometimes it's just enough to make a belter of a pop record, which I think this is.
Well, to keep the bright vibe flowing,
excellent.
My choice this week is a song with the saddest lyrics ever written.
I'm trying to guess what it is, actually.
Well, back to the lyrics in a moment, but this song is notable for the sort of gorgeous understated guitar solo by one of the 60s and 70s greatest session guitarists here in the UK. You know, as the States had Hal Blaine and the Wrecking Crew, London had Big Jim Sullivan, many people won't have heard of. But Big Jim Sullivan, he played guitar on over, this is the most extraordinary stat, 800 chart hits he played on, 54... UK number ones. Ichiku Park, It's Not Unusual, Make It Easy on Yourself, Something in the Air,
He's had more number one hits than the Beatles and Cliff and possibly Elvis put together, hasn't he, in the UK?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Most extraordinary. Big Jim Sullivan played on them all. I think we'd struggle to find anyone else who's played on 54 UK number one records at all, as you say, accumulating, the Beatles and everybody else. So, yes, Big Jim Sullivan plays the guitar solo on this track. It's by Gilbert O'Sullivan. In 1973, I was very young and living in Weybridge in rather posh circumstances, a large house built on a golf course. Next door across the fairway of this golf course was Sunny Heights, a house called Sunny Heights.
It sounds a little bit like a sort of an American teen soap opera, I must admit, the way you're setting this up. Or Home and Away. It sounds a bit sort of Summer Bay and Yabby Creek type stuff.
It had that sort of vibe on it. Sunny Heights, which was next door, that was where Ringo had lived in the 1960s. And next door to Sunny Heights was Gilbert O'Sullivan's house. Wow. So, it was where the new money came.
I was going to say that is nouveau rather than sort of old school, isn't it? Really?
It really was, yes. And young teenagers would make the long walk. It was a long walk from Weybridge Railway Station with their Gilbert O'Sullivan badges kind of firmly pinned onto their cardigans. And they would hang around outside his front gates. Again, difficult to believe, he went 40 years on, that...
he was the One Direction of his day, wasn't he? But on a much, much smaller scale.
Smaller scale, indeed. These girls used to be standing outside and they'd just scream every time a car came along. It was obviously usually the TV repairman or the postman.
People do that to me when I'm on my way to work, obviously.
I can imagine. That's probably the reason. You were saying that there's nobody coming into Hastings. That's because they know you're coming out. They're all following you. There she goes.
I did wonder who they were, I must admit.
Yeah, that's all your fans. Gilbert O'Sullivan, he wasn't taken very seriously as either a songwriter or performer.
He's not often mentioned in the same breath as Cohen, is he, really?
He's not, frankly, Juliet. No, at the height of his chart success, even, those sort of words weren't used to describe him. I think it was perhaps because he wore a silly costume.
Well, I remember seeing someone going on Stars in Their Eyes, remember that once, being Gilbert O'Sullivan, and they had a jumper with a G on it, and that's always how I picture Gilbert O'Sullivan.
when he started off, he wore a kind of schoolboy's outfit, which was awful. It really didn't work at all. And then when he swerved into rather light entertainment, that's when the cardigan with the big G on it came into play.
I've made some poor fashion choices in my time, I have to be honest. And I don't think even I would wear a jumper with one of my initials on it. I'd like to think I'm still off that kind of bit.
Yeah, same here. I haven't gone down that route at all. If we take a look back at those early singles, Nothing Rhymed, We Will, and Claire, it's a sort of wonderful way he had with lyrics. It's obviously in retrospect, but you know, great emotional waves and superb arrangements and orchestration. But for me, Gilbert O'Sullivan's greatest work is Alone Again Naturally.
Oh, I think I am with you on this. I do think that's a lovely song.
It was only in his early 20s when he wrote it, and the song is a sort of astonishing tale of being alone. It's firstly a man jilted at the altar, and then a woman suffering the loss of her husband. It doesn't sound very cheery,
it's a bit thematically different to O'Connor Pop, isn't it, really? Let's face it.
It is. We've gone to two extremes here. I was going to quote from the lyrics, but they absolutely genuinely make me kind of a bit tearful. They didn't in the 1970s, but they do now, which perhaps says a lot, you know, about me and my age.
It says a lot about the record, I think, as well. The idea that something can move you over time and become more rather than less relevant, I think, shows the quality of it.
It wasn't autobiographical, and it didn't relate to his circumstances, and that, to me, makes it even more remarkable that at that very young age he chose such sort of gorgeous imagery to get the piece across about being alone and the part about where as I say, not autobiographical, but the writer's father and then mother dies, and the feelings that evokes in him. It's absolutely, you know, spot on the nail.
I'm sitting at my dining room table doing this, and I've just sort of clung to the table a bit when you said that, because it kind of made me reel a little bit, just kind of thinking of it in those terms.
Well, you know, we'll play a snippet of it at the end of the podcast, and then it'll turn up on the big playlist on the Rocking Vico website and on Magnus Shaw's Spotify playlist. Mm. And I do recommend anybody to have a listen to it with perhaps fresh ears and listen to the words and as I say, the arrangement and the orchestration. And, you know, I listen to it afresh now, and I find it very sort of meaningful. It was recorded in 1971, released in 1972. It reached number 3 on the UK Top 40, but number 1 for 6 weeks on the Billboard Hot 100. It's 3 minutes, 36 seconds, and as I say, it's Gilbert O'Sullivan, Alone Again, Naturally. So, that second choice, Juliet, that brings us to the close for this week. So I've just got to say thank you so much, Juliet, for joining us. You've been absolutely wonderful.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say so. It's been a total pleasure. I did do a little air punch when I got the email sort of calling me up. I'm just really chuffed to have been asked, really. I'm a big fan of all of the Rocking Vicar menagerie, and I'm sort of pleased to be a little part of it, really. I thank you so much.
And thank you, everybody at home, for listening. And just to let you know, Juliet and I will be back next week. But until then, it's bye for now. Thank you.
father died, never wishing to dry the tears. And at 65 years old, my mother, God rest her soul, couldn't understand why the only man she had ever loved had been taken, leaving her to start with a heart so badly broken. Despite encouragement from me, no words were ever spoken. When she passed away, cried and cried all day, alone again, naturally, alone again, naturally.
You have been listening to a Dacom Shore media production.
So you disagree with Obamacare?
Yes, I do.
Do you think insurance companies should be able to exclude people with pre-existing conditions?
No.
Do you agree that young people should be able to stay on their parents' plans until they are 26?
They should be able to, yes.
Do you agree that companies with 50 or more employees should provide health care?
I do.
And so by that logic, you would be for the Affordable Care Act?
Yes.
What plan do you support, Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act?
The Affordable Care Act.
And why do you support that over Obamacare?
I do not like Obamacare. I don't like anything that has to be forced for everybody to buy. This is not good.
Do you think Obamacare is socialist?
Yes, I do.
Do you think the Affordable Care Act is socialist?
No.
Do you believe that Obamacare will eventually lead to gun prohibition?
Yes.
Do you know that Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act are the same thing?
No, they're not. Thanks, you made me look stupid.
That's what we do.
Okay, you did good.
Oh, hey, look, it's the audience. Welcome. Welcome, stupid people. You have a home here with me.